joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. You know him best as the longtime anchor of the highly regarded PBS NewsHour. He's also an accomplished playwright, acclaimed novelist, and dear friend. His 20th book, Super, is a nostalgic whodunit based on a real-life murder mystery that took place on the old Santa Fe Railway. Jim Lehrer joins me in the studio to talk about his new novel, the continuing evolution of journalism, his love for a bygone era of trains, and the small towns that flourished around them. Jim Lehrer is here in the studio. You can join us as well, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Jim Lehrer, you're starting your book tour right here on this show again.
Diane, you know, I think we've done this for over ten books.
Absolutely.
And it's great to see you. Great to this is my idea of the launch, you know. And we have done it. I'm trying to figure out when the first book was, and I think it was about 10 or 11 books ago. And
I think it was one of the One-Eyed Mac
books. That's right.
And that would have been a good
Oklahoma books. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And well, so this is where it all starts.
It's good to see you again.
Thank you, Diane. Thank you. Can I say one thing, one personal thing? Congratulations on the Peabody Award.
Oh.
As somebody who's in the same line of work, broadcast, I know how important the Peabody is. It's a real award for real achievement. And you deserve it, and I am just so happy that the folks who were in charge of that figured that out, and I congratulate you, and it should be broadcast and heralded and billboards put up. Diane Rehm, winner of the Peabody Award.
Thank
it's a
you.
Fabulous thing, Diane.
Thank you. Going up to New York mid-May to receive that wonderful award, and thank you for the letter you wrote in my behalf.
Well, you know, I'm in the truth business. All I did was write the truth.
That's lovely. Jim Lehrer, tell us about Super and the Super Chief Train.
Well, Super is what the folks who worked on the railroad called the Super Chief. Now, the Super Chief was the all Pullman, all sleeper car, first-class train, went from Chicago to Los Angeles. It was called the Train of the Stars because the movie stars rode on the train, and then they'd switch in Chicago to the Pennsylvania Railroad's Broadway Limited or the New York Central's 20th Century Limited and go on to New York. And usually they'd have dinner or lunch or whatever at the pump room in Chicago between trains and shop at Marshall Field and all that sort of stuff. But it became quite a deal. But because of the movie stars, there was all kinds of adventure on these trains. And Judy Garland, in real world, Judy Garland once woke up one night. She was with a guy and decided to marry him. And they got the engineer to preside over their wedding and all of that. My book takes place in the 1956, about it's a round trip essentially between starts at Dearborn Station, Chicago, goes to Union Station, Los Angeles, and then a return trip. And I've got Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert, and I've got Harry Truman, and a journalist who is resembles a bit the son of William Allen White, the Sage of Emporia. And I got some other movie people that are fictional people that I made up, and I got a little atomic bomb story. And I just kind of threw a lot of wonderful things in there, wonderful things to me at least. It's just great fun.
But, you know, people think of you as a bus man.
Yeah.
And now here you've turned to trains. Have trains been part of your thinking?
Absolutely right. I grew up in these little towns in Kansas, as you know, Diane. And the Santa Fe streamliners, not just the super chief, but there was the chief, the El Capitan, San Francisco Limited, or all kinds of trains, and they all went the main line right through the heart of Kansas from Chicago on the way to the West Coast. And I lived in little towns where these speeding silver streaks would come through the prairie, and those little towns, and they never stopped in the towns where I lived, seldom stopped in the towns where I lived at least. And they were kind of the magic carpets for everybody who lived out there. They sure certainly were for me. One day I'm going to get on one of those trains, and one day that's where I'm going to find my destiny on one of those trains. I don't know where in the hell I was going to go or why, but it wasn't just me personally, but it was the symbol for people. Okay, going away to the service, going away to school, running away from home, whatever it was, that was where you were going to do it. Now, buses are the same way. Buses came through these little towns, and they'd come through, and you'd see the bus come in, and people would get on the bus, and, oh, my God, one day I'm going to get on a bus. It's all part of the same thing.
How did your parents feel about that drive in you to get out?
They bought into it. They were all part of it. My dad was a busman, and his whole deal was that, son, you see a bus come, and you look up, and same thing with a train. You look up, and you see a train, or your passenger train, or you see a bus, and you look up, and you want to know, son, you want a face in every window and a bottom on every seat. And that was the whole thing. And that was the way people moved. There were no cars. Nobody had cars. We didn't own a car. Right. Nobody owned a car.
Right.
And the other specific thing about my dad was he worked for Santa Fe Trailways, which was a bus company headquartered in Wichita, Kansas. And that's where I was born. And he worked for them, a predecessor company, Southern Kansas Stage Line. Then it became Santa Fe Trailways, and it was owned by the Santa Fe Railroad. So the rail Santa Fe and the Santa Fe Railroad were all part of my early life, and it was all Midwest, it was all Kansas, and particularly Wichita. So it's all one big great lump in my life.
Read for us from the book. There is a passage where Clark Gable gets on the train.
Here now was Clark Gable, a star. Now, there are four or five categories of passengers on the Super Chief, at least internally, and regulars are people who go all the time, and a star is anybody who's a real star, and of course Clark Gable was a star. Anyhow, here now is Clark Gable, a star, coming down the station platform. Now this is Dearborn Station, Chicago. Coming down the station platform toward his sleeping car, a red cap named James was taking care of him and his luggage. Darwin Reinhardt, now he's a movie producer, a regular meaning he rode the Super Chief all the time. Anyhow, Darwin Reinhardt, a regular, felt a flash of joy and well-being for the first time in months. "Hey, King Clark," he called out. The King of Hollywood, as they called Clark Gable, jerked his head in Reinhardt's direction, but after only a glance, turned back away. The message was unmistakable, but Reinhardt chose to ignore it. "Gable's not going to talk to you," said Gene Matthews, who's a friend of Reinhardt's. He's another regular, an associate of Reinhardt's in the movie business. "Don't humiliate yourself, for God's sake," that's what Matthews said to Reinhardt. Reinhardt said, "Go ahead and get us settled." He spoke quietly to Russell, his own red cap. He and James would be handsomely rewarded for providing this special treatment by boarding the Super Chief early and privately before all the other passengers. Reinhardt had no idea, of course, that a private had preceded him, had preceded them a few minutes early. A private is a form of passenger who is actually paid a sleeping car conductor or attendant to ride the train free. In other words, without a ticket. You might have a $75 ticket if you bought it from the railroad. You'd pay a sleeping car, and if the train wasn't full, maybe $50 to go. And that was a private
That's
passenger.
Right.
Anyhow, Reinhardt approached Gable while Matthews and James headed to the first car, which was half sleeping accommodations and a bar lounge at the end of the Super Chief, which was backed into the platform for loading. While the Super was still known and celebrated as the Train of the Stars, some of its Hollywood glitter had switched to airliners. Earl Flynn and his pair of lion-sized dogs that often traveled with him were long gone from the super. So were William Holden, Cecil B. DeMille, and Grace Dodsworth. Gloria Swanson, Claudette Colbert, Edward G. Robinson, and Judy Garland were the major remaining stars. Recently, Judy Garland had even had a mock wedding ceremony performed by a super engineer during a brief stop someplace in Arizona or New Mexico. But the real super fan among the stars had always been Clark Gable. There wasn't a porter, steward, barber, or conductor on this train who didn't have a Clark Gable story to tell, most of them concerning booze and or women.
He was on that train.
He was on that train. Well, that's what it appears to be. That's all I'm going
to
say.
That's what it appears to be, and that's wonderful. What he does, Reinhardt does approach him, and he doesn't put out his hand because he sees money is changing hands between Clark Gable and the porter. And then Clark Gable just snubs him because Reinhardt asks him to have dinner or a drink. He says, I don't have time to do that.
I don't have time.
I mean, these celebrities, you are in that situation many times, I'm sure, when people approach you on planes, on trains. How do you deal with it?
Well, I'm a much nicer person than Clark Gable.
I would think so.
Thank you very much. My view of this is very simplistic. It's not like a movie star. If somebody knows who I am, that means they have to watch the NewsHour. That's a good person.
Jim Larry and his new book, his 20th, is titled Super. We'll take a short break. Your calls when we come back, 800-433-8850. Welcome back to our conversation with PBS NewsHour anchor Jim Lehrer. His new book, a novel based on real events, is titled Super. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. How did you find this story that has this basis in truth?
Well, Diane, to be truthful about it, it's only about 10% based on
truth.
The rest of it I made up.
That's okay.
And the basic truth is there was a super chief, and there were a lot of movie stars went on there. The Clark Gable, the fact that he wrote it all the time is certainly true. Harry Truman used to ride. Of course, he was a big train. He didn't like to fly. And Harry Truman, grew up and lived in Independence, Missouri, which is right there by Kansas City. So it was a natural thing to put him on the train and all of that. And there were a lot of people through, and I researched this, there were a lot of incidents about on the train where a lot of things happened, including that resulted in dead bodies and that sort of thing. And so I paraphrased some of that and used it to my benefit. But it's uh, uh, I I uh, I did my best to, through my research, which is the fun part, let's face it, I do my best to make people truly feel like they're on that train
and
in a real-world way, because that's the fun part.
Well, and, you know, you have for years had this wonderful bus call, and now for this book, you developed a new train call.
Yeah, well, you know, I started doing a bus call when I first did it here on your program many years ago for a novel called White Widow, which was about a Trailways bus driver in the 1950s, South Texas, et cetera. And that was based on my experience as a ticket agent when I was going to a little junior college in South Texas in the 1950s. And that was the first time I was paid money to speak into a microphone, was to call buses and all the PAs. I loved doing it. And so I started doing it, starting with your program, and then it was a kind of on book tour. It was a gig. When you go out on to sell books, you got to have a gig.
Absolutely.
So I did the bus call, and that's where I loved it so much. Now I do it everywhere. You know, it's just a good luck charm.
You even did it at commencement when you received, with your wife, Kate, an honorary degree from McDaniel College.
Exactly. I have done it with black tie dinners and white tie, any kind of tie, no tie dinners. It's just my little badge of luck. And but I decided that, again, in the interest of commerce, as I go away from your studio today and commence a book tour, that it made sense to have a gig that related to the super. And so I took my skills as a bus caller, and now I have a new call. It goes like this. May I have your attention, please? At track 7, passengers may now board train 17, the Super Chief, the Atchison, Topeka, and the Santa Fe's, first class, all sleeping car, express streamliner to Los Angeles. Making stops only at Fort Madison, Kansas City, Newton, Dodge City, La Junta, Raton, Albuquerque, Gallup, Winslow, Flagstaff, Needles, Barstow, San Bernardino, Pasadena, and Union Station, Los Angeles. All aboard the Super Chief, Track 7. Thank you for going the Santa Fe way.
Wonderful.
Now, if that doesn't sell books, nothing will.
That's so good.
Oh, it's fun.
You put yourself up in that nasal, total nasal area to do that.
Well, it's a skill,
yeah.
Diane.
It's a skill.
Now
and you've developed
that
it.
I can not only call buses, I can also call trains.
Absolutely. We've gotten a message from Facebook. It's from David, who says, is it true that Mr. Lehrer never votes in presidential elections to preserve his objectivity?
You know, that's not so. And what happened at many, many years ago, when I first started moderating presidential debates, somebody asked me about voting. And I told the story about when I was first in journalism, I covered politics for a newspaper in Dallas, Texas. And in Dallas, and I went to vote at school next near our house, and it was a primary vote. And when you walked in, and I was known as a political reporter, political columnist, and I walked in to vote, and you had to declare in front of everybody whether you were a Republican or a Democrat to vote in the primary. And I looked around, and they were all looking at me. Am I a Republican or a Democrat? And I said, you know, I think I'll take a pass.
Huh.
And so I just decided. And it was a very, very anguished time in politics in Dallas, Texas in the 60s when I was covering politics. And so I just decided to put that aside. And I made the mistake of a reporter who was doing a story at the time. It wasn't his fault. I just didn't make it clear. I said, well, and then I kind of got into the habit and I felt more comfortable not voting when and all of this, not have to get in the way of my reporting, making a decision myself. The fact of the matter is my voting is no different than anybody else. It's a very private matter. Fact of the matter is I do what I do like all citizens do, and I'll just leave it at that. But the reason people it's understood because it did get in print, and I made the mistake of saying, well, that's true, and I told stories. Stories have to be short. My story is too long, as I just demonstrated as to what my voting problem was and why I had it.
But you are voting.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Of
I'm a registered voter in the District of Columbia, and I do my thing as I wish to do it.
Jim Lehrer, and if you'd like to join us, 800-433-8850. Jim, did you ever get to ride the super chief?
No. My wife Kate and I rode the Southwest Limited, which is an Amtrak train, it still runs. It's a successor to the super chief. Takes almost the exact same route, but it does. It's not as chair cars. It's not. It ain't the same thing, but it's. I've been close, but I never was on the Santa Fe Super
never
Chief.
Never even got
no,
on it.
No, the Super Chief was for people above my strata. I mean, it really was for movie stars and people who could pay. Super Chief, had a barbershop. It had a private dining room in addition to the dining room called the Turquoise Room, that you could reserve and have cocktail parties with your friends and have romantic dinners. And the train when it went through Colorado, they'd put on fresh fish that they had caught there. In Newton, Kansas, they had their own bakery, their own dairy that they manufactured fresh food of all kinds they put on the trains. And it was quite an operation. Mm-hmm. And the old Fred Harvey Company pioneered food on the Santa Fe. It began at the train stations, and then they started putting them on the trains. It was a really plush way to travel. I was never a plush traveler.
It seems to me that, especially we were talking about this Icelandic volcano, mm-hmm. and the disruption to travel all across Europe and coming in to and out of Europe, we need rapid trains in this country.
Yeah. Well, I'm a big believer in that. We live in Washington and go to New York and Boston, places like that, and I always go on the train.
On the train.
It's just so much more pleasant.
Of
and
course.
It's easy to do. And there have been many efforts in the past to create high-speed trains, like, say, on corridors, like from Dallas to Houston, San Antonio, from Chicago to St. Louis. There are some working down the West Coast, San Francisco south to Los Angeles and San Diego. It's always made, it seems to me, perfect economic sense and environmental sense to create these trains, but they're very expensive, and it's an infrastructure thing. And the airlines, have really flourished. And before that, there was the interstate car system. The interstate car system essentially destroyed passenger rail service. And now everybody wishes they hadn't.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because now the cars and the highways and the roads are so crowded with cars.
I want to ask you a couple of more things about Super, your new novel. You got some deaths on this train.
Yeah.
It's very confusing because nobody knows yet whether this guy killed himself or was murdered.
Well, there are two of them, actually, and what ties them together thematically is that both of these folks loved riding the Super Chief mm-hmm. so much mm-hmm. through the years that's where they chose to die. And whether or not they chose it for suicidal reasons or whatever, We can leave that to the readers to figure out. But it's all part of the idea of a, you know, the super cheap going on streamliner trains, first class trains during that era, was literally like going into another world. And those folks who rode those trains regularly, like the regulars, like Clark Gable, and there were other people who were, you know, not as well known, but who could afford it financially, it was truly like going into a luxury environment, closed environment. You know, that was before you didn't have cell phones, you didn't have phones of any kind.
Like the Orient Express.
Like the Orient Express, exactly. And you were among people of your kind.
Status. In other words,
people who are either celebrities for artistic reasons or accomplishment reasons, or celebrities because they had a lot of money in their pocket. And it was not public. It was not a public way to go. It was almost a private way.
On the other hand, here is Harry Truman, and he gets confronted by a man who wants to know whether he, Harry Truman, anticipated the kind of long-term health problems the atomic bomb caused.
Yeah. And I was a big fan of Harry Truman, partly because of where I grew up. My aunt and uncle and my cousins lived in Kansas City, and we'd spent a lot of time there when I was living in Kansas. And in fact, I grew up thinking Kansas City was the biggest city in the world. I don't know about all these other places, but when we'd go to see my family, Harry Truman, who was president at the time in the 40s, he would come around. I mean, you'd see him at the Muehlbach Hotel or at parades and that sort of thing. And I always had a great admiration for him, not for political reasons. I just thought he was terrific. I mean, he's a guy who came out of nowhere and became president of the United States and all of that. And he made the decision. I was thinking about getting ready to do this book. I read, of course, David McCullough's book, Truman, did a lot of other research about Truman. And while he had no remorse, no second thoughts about having used the nuclear the atomic bomb, and I did a lot of reading about that, about the decision he made, how he made it, and all that sort of stuff. He did, in his later life, and is mentioned in a book in passing, that he was concerned about what happened afterward, the growth of nuclear testing that followed the bomb in peacetime. And because the Cold War was on, and they did a lot of stuff in Utah, and there was fallout, and which is an element in the book Super, and Truman, it was all, you know, it's just a case of trying to tie everything, all my little stories
but
together.
He had, at least, as you put it, one little ounce of doubt.
Yeah, a little doubt. Not so much about the bomb,
doing it,
but the, what he unleashed.
Exactly.
What was unleashed by.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We have many, many callers. We'll open the phones now, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning, Bernie, in Louisville, Kentucky.
Hello, Jim. Diane.
Hi.
Hey, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Hi. It sounds like just a couple comments quickly, because I know there's lots of people waiting. Sounds like a fantastic book. I can't wait for my wife to read it. She reads a lot faster than I do, and then I'll get it. She'll read it one day, and I'll get it the next.
Good.
The other comment I wanted to make was, have you ever thought about doing a author forums tour? Our public radio station here, WFPL, hosts author forums, and they might be able to work you in if you're interested. Our Friday night, I just wanted to say, I've always wanted to tell you this, our Friday night, the PBS News Hour doesn't come on until 7 o'clock here in Louisville, Kentucky. Our Friday nights do not start until after we've heard the political wrap-up with yourself and Brooks and Shields. And we certainly do enjoy your show.
My husband feels exactly the same way, Bernie.
Thank you,
Bertie. You got to have something to talk about when you're at dinner, you know?
That's right. That's right. Well, I just one quick thing about Bernie, one quick thing about David Brooks and Mark Shields. I happen to believe that they're kind of the gold standard for civilized discourse. I mean, here's one guy who's a liberal. Another guy's a conservative. They have differing views, but they express them in a civilized manner. They don't talk over each other. They
good
don't
examples.
Shout.
Examples.
Exactly. They are, when somebody says, oh, well, you can't express, differences, without raising your voice and all that. Yes, you can. Mark and David prove it every Friday night.
And they provide such insights into what's happening in Washington rather than just reiterating. They really do. Each of them has such good contacts. They take you behind the scenes.
They're first and foremost reporters, and they're very uneasy about giving their opinions about things they don't know anything about. Sometimes, we get ready to do the segment, on Thursday and Friday, and our folks call and talk to David and talk to Mark. And sometimes one of them will say, I just don't feel qualified to talk about that. So we don't talk about it.
Good.
And, that's terrific.
Jim Lehrer, his new novel is titled Super. It's his 20th book. We'll take a short break. When we come back, more of your calls, your email. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
After covering the war in Iraq, New York Times reporter Dexter Filkins has been covering the war in Afghanistan. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with him about what he's been witnessing and the challenges the U.S. faces in trying to drive out the Taliban and help create a stable country. Join us.
And we have another announcement. Jim Lehrer has never blogged before. Today he begins. How come?
Well, I was persuaded. It didn't take a lot of persuasion, but I was persuaded that maybe this was a time to at least try it.
Okay.
And the first blog I'm going to write on the train after I leave your studio talking to you. And I'm going to take a photograph of the two of us together.
Okay.
And I'm going to post that, and I'm going to talk about, hey, book started. I'm on the train to New York, and I'm going to tell them about that Diane and I have started book tours together for the last 10 books. And I'm going to mention your Peabody, and that we're members of the same public broadcasting family. And then I'm going to mention some of the things that people ask me and all of that. And I'm going to, you know, every couple of days or so update, because I'm going from New York, I'm going to Texas, and I'm going to Chicago, and then to Kansas City and Albuquerque, Los Angeles, Austin, a bunch of places on this book tour. And so I'm just going to get, these aren't going to be long, exhausting
okay.
things, just a little thing, and little things that we can update. And Hari Srinivasan and our staff convinced me that this was...
He's terrific.
Yeah, he is.
He's terrific.
And he's... but I haven't set out that I'm going to have a blog from now to the end of time, only when there's something... For instance, our senior correspondents like, you know, Gwen Ifill and Judy Woodruff and Margaret Warner and Ray Suarez and Jeff Brown, they blog regularly when there's something that's happened. Ray, for instance, is caught in Europe right now because of the ash problem, and he's been blogging about that. He was in Peru. He blogged from there. He blogged from...
But essentially, their blogs are not their personal
opinions. No, not their
opinions.
Yeah. For instance, Gwen blogged recently when we did our Spotlight City from a week we broadcast from Tampa. And Gwen ran a discussion, and there was some criticism about how she, whatever, what I can't remember what it was. It was, you know, you could criticize for whatever
sure.
you do, no
sure.
matter what.
Sure.
But she felt it was worth, it was important to speak to those criticisms, and she did. And none of our bloggers, none of our staff, and certainly I won't, express any opinions about the news or any of that. It's more, it's all kind of backstory and all of that. And we have discovered, now that we have expanded our online presence, we have expanded horizontally as well as vertically the NewsHour, that people are interested in these people who appear on the air and people behind the scenes on the NewsHour, how we get our stuff together and what our philosophy is and how we do it.
Interesting.
And, yeah, and you don't have to make a big to-do about it. It's available on all these various media, and so we're going to do it.
Well, people have asked me to do it. Now that you're doing it, it may set an example. Let's go to Jerry in Charlotte, North Carolina. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking me on the air.
Certainly.
And Mr. Lehrer, thank you and both of you for giving to the American people a much needed and valuable resource. Explaining the news and giving the news the way you two do helps our democracy really survive. And thank you again for making that your career.
Thank you.
My question is, I've got really a couple of questions. The NewsHour has changed formats recently, and I'd be curious to know what your opinion is of the new format. My sense is that there's a lot more glitzy stuff been added to it to make it look good, and it does look good. But I'm a little concerned that I like the way you guys interview people and go to several levels of questions deep. In other words, on the typical network news, they may ask one question and one follow-up question. You don't do that. You ask several questions, and you don't let anybody get away with stuff. You ask, well, why is that? Well, could you explain that? And what do you mean by that? And that helps the American people really understand things. And I'm curious if you think that the NewsHour may be giving up a little bit of that and trading off for the kind of the new format. And my second question is, could you explain how you manage your time with the job you have with the NewsHour, and how do you structure your days and weeks in order to write books?
First question first. No, we have not changed our approach to the journalism or to the interviewing. The change was done because it's like anything else. If you're doing something that involves the transmission of ideas and information and all of that, and you're doing it in a growing and changing media world, you have to grow and change with the media world. It doesn't mean the content changes or the approach changes. It's just the mechanics of how you present it. And if you have detected some kind of change in our approach, then I hope you're wrong, because I hope you're imagining it, because there has been no intent to do that. Quite the contrary, the changes are, yes, they're format. There are two of us doing the anchoring. Used to be just Billy Bob there. Now there's Billy Bob and Sammy Sue, and it is the idea. In fact, it encourages. When you have two people, when you have a serious television news program, you have to use every technique there is to keep people interested, and you have to sometimes create the illusion of movement when there really isn't movement. You're just saying, you're just moving on to somebody else, and but the subject hasn't changed, and the approach hasn't changed.
And the in-depth
questions
has
and
not
we're
changed.
We're still in the in the in-depth questioning business, and we always will be.
Now, briefly, on the explain time.
Look, I learned. Diane and I've talked about this on this program before, Jerry. Bottom line here is, I learned years ago, for all kinds of reasons, that I had the time to do all the things that I wanted to do. If I just quit doing the things I didn't want to do, and that's what I did. And so I have time to do all these. I just get up early in the morning. I am a fast starter. I can go from a dead run to a dead run, doing serious journalism and then making up stories about trains on trains. And I do it. I do everything kind of at top speed, and I'm able to do that. And it gives. I only do the things I want to do. I'm sitting here talking to Diane now because I want to do this, and I'm talking to you, Jerry, because I want to do this. And but I specifically make that decision for just about everything that I do.
Here is an email from Catherine in Cincinnati. What does Mr. Lehrer think about the right-wing media manipulating public perception with misinformation, hyperbole, and incendiary rhetoric? And how can average citizens in their daily life counteract the destructive nature that such rhetoric is having in our country and neighborhoods?
Well, without, that's the kind of questions I ask, or they're not the kinds I answer. But the bottom line here is that in this new media world, where you've got blogs and Twitters and Facebooks and you name it, Hulus and woo-woos and everything else, everybody who cares about the issues, cares about our democratic society, has to work a little harder to get the information. You're going to get a lot. Yeah, there are a lot of people screaming out there on the right. There are also a lot of people screaming out there on the left. There are people screaming all the time. And there are more ways to do it. In the old days, there were people screaming, but they were screaming at each other at the street corner or across a table. Now you can do it on the radio, or now you can do it on a blog. You can do and but that means that the person who the inline consumer, in other words, the person who like the person in Cincinnati who's concerned about this, you just have to go back and find the facts on your own, and read your newspaper or go to the right websites that have. You just say, hey, you got a problem. Somebody's yelling about something, and you think, my God, this is wrong. Go find out what the facts are. And in the old days, that you didn't have to do that, but you didn't have 1,000 people yelling at you, or 1,000 people offering not just yelling, but offering various perspectives and all of that. A person in a democratic society in the United States today has to work a lot harder to make decisions. That's all this means.
And yesterday, as you well know, was the anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. The question arose, was there the same kind of rhetoric, destructive kinds of use of language? Did that lead to what happened there?
Well, there are a lot of theories about that. I would just go back to the earlier point. The megaphones are there now. There have always been anti-government feelings and from the day one, since 1775, 1776, and the ability and the encouragement to express your views about government at all levels is what is one of the platforms on which our society is based. What is new is the megaphone to express these views. And there's no connection that I'm aware of that's been provable that McVeigh was in any way stimulated to blow up the federal building in Oklahoma City because of anything he heard on the radio or anything he saw on a blog or anything somebody organized. There have always been people, pockets of people, on the fringes of all levels who are trying to get people to do things and trying to, and for the most part, they're not successful. And there's no evidence that the only thing that's different now, if you look at the percentage of the people on the far left and the far right who are rabble-rousing right now, it's about the same as it's always been. As I say, the megaphones are what is the new element.
What about the Tea Party movement? How serious do you believe it will be in our developing society?
Well, it remains to be seen. There are all kinds of polls that show that it's a very small minority of even people from the right. Whether or not it's going to grow, it depends on the megaphone and how people react to it. And the recent polls show, as I say, they're a small percentage, and just like the small percentages in all of these things, we're basically, the American people, are about 80% of the American people are in the big middle. Some of them a little to the left, some of them a little to the right. Most of the people are just people who want to, who are interested in living a good life and living a life that is meaningful. And sometimes something happens in the political world that arouses them a little more. Healthcare reform or a particular issue, financial reform, war, peace, all of these real things that happen at any given moment. The real vibrations that matter are among the folks in the middle. These are the people who do the voting and the final analysis. These are the people that truly run the country, not the people on the fringes. People on the fringes do a lot. It cause people to think about some a little bit more than they would otherwise, but they're not leading the country.
Jim Lehrer, and his new novel is titled Super. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Here's a caller from Collinsville, Oklahoma.
I know where Collinsville is.
Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Good morning. My father-in-law was a geologist with Phillips Petroleum located in Albuquerque back in the 50s.
Yep.
He got to ride all the way to Kansas City with Mr. and Mrs. Van Johnson and his family.
That's terrific.
And said he was the nicest, most polite, intelligent person he'd ever met. They talked all the way to Kansas City. The second time he got to ride with Red Skelton all the way to Kansas City.
How about that?
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah. That's terrific. I've been to Collinsville.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I lived in Independence, Kansas, and went down. My dad worked for a bus company. It went south down there in Nevada. And then, you know, Bartlesville and on into Tulsa, Claremore, all that. Ulaga. You know where Ulaga is? Well, you know where Ulaga, Oklahoma is? Rogers' home?
Oh, yes. And one other thing, I can still remember seeing the Super Chief back in the 1950s myself as it was traveling on the parallel to Route 66.
Oh, yeah.
It was spectacular.
That's terrific.
John, I'm glad you called. Let's go to Port Orange, Florida. Walter, you're on the air.
Well, thank you. When I was a young boy in the 50s, my father took us on the train. We had a double car, and we went on the Santa Fe Chief all the way out west. And at the time, being a young boy, I didn't appreciate the dining car and the all the linens and the special compartment. You know, it was a double compartment with bathrooms. But now as I'm listening to you, it's bringing back those memories. Mm.
That's terrific. Do you remember the heavy silverware?
It was quite deluxe.
Oh, man, that was a way to you were, as they say in another part of the country, you were in high cotton when you were on the Chief.
I should say, Walter, thanks for your call. And finally, to Jane in Montgomery County, Maryland, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you, Diane. I wanted to ask Mr. Lehrer about the announcement he made in December that he was going to give up the hosting the show, and it was going to be a rotating, your news program, or the news program, was going to be rotated among the various participants on the show, and that you might be leaving the station, and there was some talk that you might, actually, I don't know whether this was a rumor or whether I heard it on your news program that you might become an actor.
You know, that is a rumor, but pass it along. No, it's too late for that. I'm a journalist writer, and I'm stuck with that, and I love it. I'm a fortunate person. Fortunate to be able to do what I wanted to do since I was 16 years old. But acting, I can't conceive of that. So that's a rumor you can put to rest. But if you want to spread it after, you can spread it a little bit before you put it to rest.
But you are rotating hosts.
Oh yeah, you know, do the rotating host. Absolutely, the News Hour is a group of people. It is no longer a Billy Bob run operation. It's been a team operation for a long time, and now we just acknowledged it.
Jim Lehrer, he's anchor and executive editor of the PBS News Hour. His new novel, his 20th, is titled Super. And you are super, Jim Lehrer.
Thank you, Diane. So are you.
Good to have you
here. Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.